You immediately reacted as if he'd been killed, and you were likely to be next. They got to him, clearly. Why is that a mystery? Talia would have dearly liked to consult with Dreyfus and Daumanier and all the others in the tactical room about how much she could and could not say. But it was on her now, and she supposed making such a call was exactly what it meant to be a field prefect. We don't think there was any Ultra involvement in your husband's death. An Ultra was just trying to kill me. I need you to be frank with me, Madame Bronner. Ultras don't pick on random citizens for interrogation. Was there some reason that you and your husband might have got on the wrong side of them? Giselin Bronner raised a hand.
Please, she's tiring me with these questions.
A medic and a constable came over to her side, intent on steering her away from the widow. Talia was about to assert her authority when Sparva intervened, saying in a low voice,
"We'll get our chance with her when the heavy medicals arrive. Some new orders just came in from Panoply. We're to head straight to Addison Lovelace."
Talia edged away from the others.
"With the Ultra?"
"No.
Lady Jane wants the heavy medical squad to bring him in, quicker than waiting for us to detour to Addison Lovelace, knowing we could be there for a good few hours."
"Typical,"
she muttered.
"Is it?"
"Of course. The first time the case opens up into something larger, I'm sidelined."
"It's just expediency.
We could run the prisoner back directly, but then there'd be a delay getting someone to Terzet Friller, and that's just as critical."
"You think the Ultras will send anyone else?
Either to silence the first one, or have another go at Madame Bronner?" "Good luck to them if they do, between your whiphound and all the constables that have just showed up. No, they've had their one try, and maybe it was enough. For all we know, the kid was already relaying information to his superiors when we arrived." Talia did her bit for Panoply Constable Relations by saying thank you and goodbye to all present, taking special pains with Dane and Trelon, assuring them that they would be kept fully informed of developments relating to the Ultra. This was only true up to a point, she knew. If the present incident intersected strongly with the wildfire investigation, then there would be a limit to what could be shared, at least while the emergency was being kept under wraps. But it was good to let the constables know they had been appreciated. Hindsight was a wonderful thing. A few months ago, a general directive had gone out to all prefects to do their best to bolster relations between Panoply and the local constabularies. Talia had made nothing of it at the time, but knowing what she did now, the implications were stark. Panoply was looking ahead to the inevitable point when the number of wildfire cases became impossible to manage. At best, there were 1,000 prefects, actually rather few who were available for field duty, but the constabularies added up to a potential voluntary citizen militia numbering close to 5 million, if all were activated and mobilized across all habitats. Still only 1 in 20 of the entire populace, and that was an optimistic upper estimate, but perhaps enough to make a difference, or at least delay the collapse of all order. They reached the corvette, at last able to talk as freely as they wished. Inside the ship there was an update from Panoply, a biographical summary of the Ultra, cross-matched from biometric and genetic data, sampled by her whiphound, and then fed through to the search turbines.
"He's only known to us because he's screwed up already," Sparva said.
"Dreyfus is saying it doesn't fit in with what we already know about wildfire, and I'm inclined to agree." He was unbuckling his belt and whiphound, stowing them for the duration. "I'll tell you something else." Talia had half her attention on the flight controls, locking in a rapid crossing to Addison Lovelace.
"Go on."
Far from being an outlier, Antal Bronner had started looking like a clear fit to Dreyfus's theory. What's more risky than getting on the wrong side of the Ultras?
"Supposition until we know more."
Sparva touched his snout.
"Trust your deputy's instincts."
They undocked, pushed back, cleared the immediate airspace around Shigamints, and then fell on to their course. To save time rounding up her subjects, Talia called ahead and requested a general gathering of Terzet Friller's colleagues at some location close to the docking hub, regardless of present shift patterns or those applicable at the time of death.
She was careful to stress the routine, procedural nature of the interviews, making it clear she was not looking for a culpable party.
Dreyfus wouldn't have done it that way, Sparva said, when she had closed the link. He'd have kept them stewing. No point letting people know they're off the hook before you've grilled them.
Well, I want your opinion about Dreyfus's way of doing things, Talia said, stung.
I'll be sure to ask for it.
She checked the console. They were still more than 30 minutes from docking, and she felt she had said all she needed to for the time being. If she said more, something very unwise was likely to slip out of her mouth. It was going to be an exceedingly long half hour. Chapter 5 Julius could have found his brother the easy way, by querying his location in the consensual information field, but that would have gone against the spirit of their games. Not that they were much given to hide-and-seek lately. They had grown in the last year, and there were narrow places inside the white tree that it was difficult for Julius to squeeze through, and all but impossible for the larger, beefier Caleb. Beyond that, both boys now accepted that they had much more challenging pursuits available. Nonetheless, the tree still formed the focal point of their day's play and education. Julius knew if he could not find his brother in the winding white chambers of the shell house, the tree was as good a starting place as any. There was a hollow, sheltered space near the top, reached most easily by shinning up inside the trunk, with room enough for Caleb and Julius to sit in relative comfort and still have a commanding view of their surroundings. Julius saw Caleb's feet and legs dangling down into the trunk before he saw the rest of him.
"Do you ever think of the other place?"
Julius asked, heaving himself up by his elbows and squeezing on to the natural shelf that formed the kind of seat.
"I had a dream about it last night. I keep telling you, no one's interested in your stupid dreams. I was looking out of a window, and it was all stormy and yellow outside. Another boy was trying to tell me something important. It was something to do with the Ursus, and why they were there. I didn't really understand what he meant, but I knew I had to tell you as well.
I've come up with a new game for us, Caleb said, affecting bored indifference.
Don't you ever have dreams like that?
Shut up and listen. I've made some animals for us to hunt.
I don't want to hunt animals.
They aren't real.
Caleb pinched Julius's arm, a little too hard for it to be brotherly teasing.
They're just illusions, like plumage. I can see them wandering around, moving through the trees and gardens. Lions, tigers, some deer and rhino. Maybe an elephant, if I can be bothered.
Julius sniffed uninterestedly.
I can't see them, and I've just walked through the gardens.
He had a certain intuition about where Caleb's ideas and games tended to lead, and it was usually some form of unpleasantness.
You can't see them yet because you haven't given me permission. It's more serious than plumage. Everyone knows what plumage is and where you expect to find it. These are different. Now, do you remember Father telling us about symbolic consent?
Caleb nodded encouragingly.
Yes, I suppose,
Julius said again. Idly, he traced his finger over the area of the tree's dead interior, where they had taken turns to assert their names, over and over again, using knives stolen from the household.
I am Julius. I am Caleb. I am Julius. I am Caleb. It works like this, Caleb said. I shape an image with my plumage, something simple but definite. Look at my hand, brother, not those stupid scratches.
Julius looked. Caleb had his hand open, his palm to the sky. To the dome, rather, above the tree. Floating just over his palm was a yellow star, one of the jester-faced ones that Caleb liked to make when he juggled.
Now what?
Julius asked.
You reach out and take the symbol. I'll permit it. The act itself gives me authority to modify your perceptual field within agreed constraints. In simple terms, it just means you'll see and hear the same animals I do. Smell them, too, if they're close enough. Can't we just look at the animals instead of hunting them? If that's what you want, of course. But you have to see them first, don't you?
Tentatively, Julius reached out for the yellow star. His fist closed around its insubstantiality, but his skin prickled at something, almost as if he had squeezed an electrically charged soap bubble, and when he moved the star from Caleb's open palm to his own, it was hard to shake the sense that a physical transaction had taken place. Symbols appeared in Julius's vision. The exact pattern of them was unfamiliar, but he had already learned how to navigate and select options. Now he was being given a range of time variables, which determined how long the symbolic consent would remain in play. 1 hour, 13 hours, 26 hours, a week, and so on, with the option to specify his own time limit, or set it according to flexible conditions. Julius knew that Caleb would expect him to be timid at this point, to choose the weakest setting.
26 hours, he said. Very good,
Caleb said, sounding more impressed than Julius had expected.
I didn't think. Just show me the animals, all right? Because I bet I can shape better ones than you.
Caleb grinned.
I'd be happy to see you try, but it'll take you longer than you think. I don't know. I think I'm getting better at visual shaping than you.
You're better with quick matter, but then you never let me get enough practice with the malleable stuff.
Is it because you're worried I might turn out to be better with that as well?
Let's go hunt, Caleb said. Even Julius had to admit the animals were something of a triumph on Caleb's part. Whatever crudities he had been expecting, the actuality was much more lifelike and detailed than he would have been prepared to give his brother credit for. Caleb stayed coy about exactly how many animals he had set loose in the grounds of the shell house, but it had to be 20 or more. Each animal was a ghost, imprinted on their vision by neural interfaces, tapping into the visual processing system of their brains. But the ghosts all had goals and routines of their own, carefully matched to the likely characteristics of the real animals, and as far as Julius could tell, the hunter-prey relationships were convincingly replicated. The tigers stalked alone. The indolent lions hunted in packs. The deer moved in ever-nervous herds, responsive to the tiniest gesture or shift in their environment. What the animals did not do was predate on each other, but their mock interactions were sufficient to create a complex dynamic system of movements, an emergent whole that was undoubtedly richer than any of Caleb's base-level algorithms. It helped that the shell house grounds were easily large enough for such games. The enclosing dome, the limit of Julius and Caleb's world, was 3 kilometers across, with a circumference of more than 9 kilometers. The shell house only took up a small area under the middle of the dome, with the rest of the space given over to the gardens and woods. Paths radiated out from the forecourt of the house, connected by circular crosswalks, but the formality of the grounds only extended 1 kilometer out from the house, with the remaining parts becoming increasingly wild and rambling, including pockets of dense woodland. 20 or more ghost animals were easily lost in that expanse, so there was no danger of Caleb's game being over too soon.
They won't go near the house, that's all I know, Caleb said, and even if they did, Mother and Father wouldn't be able to see them, nor would Dr. Stasov, if he was dropping by. You haven't given them permission, but how do you know they can't see them anyway? I set the rules, not them, Caleb said.
They came across a tiger, first of all, creeping its way through foliage with complete obliviousness to their presence. Julius pointed and whispered, mesmerized by the huge and beautiful form. Caleb said there was no need for stealth. He had set up the animals' algorithms so they had no awareness of their human watchers.
I could make them respond to us, he mused aloud,
as if the idea was new.
Hunt us, even, or flee from us. It wouldn't need much of a change in their routines.
Julius's heart sank. Caleb already had something laid out in his head, some grand plan stretching weeks or months into the future, for which Julius would be no more than a component, willing or otherwise.
"Isn't it just enough to make the animals?"
he asked, knowing the reaction his question was likely to provoke.
"That's your problem. Always satisfied with what you've got. Here, see if you can shoot the tiger."
Caleb had passed Julius the malleable staff. He had shaped it into the form of a hunting rifle, with a stock, a pair of long barrels, and a stub of a trigger. Julius took it dubiously, knowing it would be forced on him one way or another. Deciding it was better to go along with his brother than argue about it, he settled the stock against his shoulder and sighted along the barrel. The tiger was still passing behind the foliage, its form broken into a near-abstract pattern of moving stripes, hard to correlate into a single creature. Julius aimed the rifle at what he thought was the tiger's middle, and squeezed the trigger stub. The rifle made a loud bang, and a line of fire struck out from the barrel. The tiger roared and slumped into the foliage, taken down with a single shot. Julius passed the rifle back to his brother.
"If you expect me to be impressed that you put the bang and the flash into my head," he started,
but the words dried up on his lips. The fact was that Caleb had impressed him. Julius felt as if he had killed the tiger, as if there had been more than just a symbolic function to the quick matter rifle.
"Let's see what else we can kill," Caleb said.
Dreyfus waited until he had confirmation that the heavy medical squad had departed the Shigamint Spindle with both the Bronner Widow and the Ultra Agent. He slept for 3 hours, waking 10 minutes before the ship was due in, splashed cold tea down his throat, then washed and clothed himself before making his way down to the docking bay. Giselin Bronner had been kept in a separate part of the ship, unaware of the other passenger, and the squad had the good sense to offload her first. Dreyfus made a point of meeting her as soon as she was through the airlock. She looked older and thinner than the biographical images he had already seen, more than could be accounted for by the strain of the last couple of days. "Thank you for your cooperation in coming here," he said, adopting a suitably deferential tone. "It's appreciated, especially after your ordeal, and coming so soon after the loss of your husband. You had every right to expect better protection."
"Your operative seemed to imply I was lucky to have been helped at all."
"My operative?" Dreyfus asked mildly, determined to keep things civil.
"The girl."
Dreyfus smiled tightly. "I'm sure she meant well by it. We were certainly fortunate to reach you when we did. I'm glad we did, and glad we got that device off you before it inflicted any more discomfort."
"Discomfort? That's what you call it?"
"It was an ultra device, and an ultra agent was sent to deploy it. That's unusual, Madame Bronner. Wouldn't you agree?"
"Is it? You tell me."
"As a rule, they restrict their vendettas to other ultras, or those among us who have business dealings that intersect with their own. Yet you attracted their attention. Can you think of a reason why?"
"Have you considered mistaken identity?"
"I'd be rash not to, and it's always a possibility. But after your husband died, you seemed to fear for your own safety."
"My husband was murdered."
"Antal died. But we don't know that it was murder. I can also say it's highly unlikely there was ultra involvement."
"You can stand there and say that after what happened to me."
"Things aren't always as they seem, Madame Bronner." She gave him a long, appraising look.
"It's true, what they're saying. Panoply isn't serving us anymore. It's been failing us for years. Perhaps we'd all be better off without you after all."
"The beauty of a free and open society," Dreyfus said, "is that we're allowed to hold differing views."
"I want to speak to Antal."
"I can't permit it for the moment, I'm afraid. Not until I'm certain there's no risk of evidential cross-contamination. Rest assured that you'll be looked after." He nodded at the prefects, who were already waiting to escort Madame Bronner away from the dock. He was happy to let them handle the questioning. He had formed his opinion of her and did not expect to be proved wrong. She would trip herself up, sooner or later, probably sooner, and it would not take his expertise to provoke her into a mistake. It was the other guest that interested Dreyfus. He waited until Madame Bronner had cleared the area, then had the Ultra brought to a windowless cell close to the docking area. They sat opposite each other, the Ultra under restraint, Dreyfus with his hands on the table, measuring up the shifty, guileless individual opposite him. "Let's cut to the chase, Tybalt. We know your employment history. You're a low-status button boy, operating out of the parking swarm. You're not reliable enough to be trusted with the big fish, but someone like Madame Bronner, she's right up your street. Do you have anything to say?" Grobno lifted his chin in cocksure defiance.
"What would you like me to say?"
"Tell me why you killed Antal Bronner."
"That wasn't me."
"Really?
The husband dies, and a little while later we find you with a fatal interrogation device strapped to his widow? Dreyfus made a pained expression. You expect me not to draw the obvious conclusion?
I didn't do it.
Dreyfus took out his whip-hound and placed it on the table before him, rolling the handle back and forth so that it made a heavy rumbling sound. I'll be honest with you. I've got better things to be dealing with than this. I know you'd rather face justice in the parking swarm, where you have friends and handlers who look out for you.
No,
Grobner said.
Not there.
Dreyfus feigned surprise. You'd rather submit to our justice? I can't promise there'd be any grounds for leniency, Tybalt. Even if you could persuade me that you had nothing to do with Antal Brunner's death, you were trying to kill his widow. Although I suppose one could make the case that you'd have removed the pain flower if Prefect Eng hadn't disturbed you. Grobno leaned as far forward as his restraints would permit.
I didn't kill the husband. I don't know what happened to him, just that it wasn't our doing. But given what the two of them were involved with...
Dreyfus cut across him. Which was?
You haven't found out for yourselves.
Assume there are still some unanswered questions. Dreyfus kept rolling the whip-hound. It'll help your case, Tybalt. I'll stress that you were cooperative, and state my belief that you had no intention of murdering Giselin Bronner.
Is that a promise?
Dreyfus nodded. You have my word.
They were swindlers, both of them. The Bronners set themselves up as private brokers. They dealt with ultras, acted as intermediaries for richer clients, did it all... at second or third hand, never needed to go near the parking swarm, specializing in rare art goods from out system. That worked for a while, only then the Bronners got greedy, realized they could just as easily buy and sell to the ultras alone.
How would that work?
By lying, making up fake histories, fake provenances. Buy from one crew, inflate the value of an artifact, and then sell it back to another crew. Keep the margin small, not draw too much attention to what they were up to. Never deal with the same crews twice.
But eventually?
They got found out. By then, they had a lot of crews lined up to get back their losses. When Antal Bronner died, it looked like a hit. Another crew, making a move. Everyone assumed the widow would be next, so I was sent to get to her first. Nail her down. Squeeze her for information on hidden assets. Lists of clients.
Dreyfus put the whip-hound away. That's helpful to me, thank you. We'll dig into the widow's finances. Run a deep audit. I don't suppose there's any point in asking who sent you? Grobno slumped, as if some vital energy had just drained out of him.
I've told you everything I know.
I suspect you have, Tybalt. Dreyfus stood from the table. It's unfortunate for you that you got snagged up in something much bigger than a simple grudge over a pair of small-time brokers.
What will happen to me now?
You'll remain here for the time being. Once I've debriefed the other prefects, there'll be a decision about how to proceed with you. Generally, in these matters to do with ultras, I mean, they tend to follow my recommendations.
Then you'll say that I shouldn't go back, won't you? You were right, Prefect Dreyfus. I'm nothing to them, just a button boy. And now I've let them down.
You don't fancy submitting yourself to their mercy. Dreyfus put on a sympathetic look. Well, I don't blame you for that. Ultra-justice can be a bit of a lottery.
Then you'll keep your word, won't you? You won't send me back.
I said I'd stress that you were cooperative, Dreyfus answered. I never said who I'd be stressing it to. He left the room. As they completed their approach, Talia got her first good view of Carousel Addison Lovelace. It was an 8-spoked cogwheel, 2 kilometers in diameter, the rim of the wheel only a few hundred meters in cross-section, the outer surface pebble-dashed in a continuous dark strip of compacted asteroidal rubble. The walls of the wheels were windowless, blank except for the occasional radiator or service port. Whatever went on in there was safe from prying eyes. The spokes met at a circular hub, the main docking and utility core for the wheel. There were lights on, windows lit, and ample evidence of ongoing activity. A dozen or so ships were already docked, clustered tight like a huddle of skyscrapers.
They were construction and cargo haulers. Ugly, utilitarian affairs, their skeletal frames wrapped around a gristle of engines, fuel tanks and freight modules. A vacant port lay near the middle of the concentration.
"This will be tight," Talia said,
using manual thruster control to synchronize the corvette's axial spin with the habitat.
"You want some help?"
"No, thank you." Outside, the hulls of the cargo transports began to slide by, seemingly close enough to touch. An anti-collision caution alarm sounded. Talia silenced it contemptuously, thinking it was just being overcautious, then had to apply a pulse of corrective thrust as one of the hulls loomed in without warning.
"Rotations off-center," Sparva said.
"I noticed." She had it down now, anticipating the fore and aft movement of the surrounding hulls caused by the oddly lopsided spin. A few moments later, the corvette clamped on with its nose lock, then extended safety bracing to the surrounding ships. Talia sent a routine message back to Panoply, confirming their arrival, then floated to the stores locker to buckle on her whiphound. Sparva was at the suit wall, waiting to go through.
"No need," Talia said. "Suits will only slow us down, and we can't very well conduct interviews while wearing them. The hub's pressurized, and we shouldn't need to go any deeper into the habitat. Unless you have other ideas?"
"I'm at your disposal," Sparva said, moving to the normal lock. Talia eyed him, picking up a note of insubordination in his answer, then pushed on ahead, cycling through to the reception area on the other side. It was a grubby, cluttered place, staffed with boxes and half-abandoned equipment. About 3 dozen workers were waiting for them in the near-weightless area, stationed at odd angles and wearing a colourful motley of spacesuit components. Many of their suits had been decorated with customized paint jobs and welded-on refinements. The workers had their helmets off, and some of them had undone their gloves, stretching their fingers and rubbing ointment into tired joints. Male, female, neutroids, a range of ages and ethnicities, but all with the same hardness in the eyes, all with the same look of lean, leathery toughness. Scars, grafts, prosthetics, a toll of damage earned, accepted, shrugged off as a necessary precondition of the work. The place smelled of oil and old sweat.
"I am Prefect Eng," she said. "This is Prefect Bancal. Thank you for gathering here ahead of our arrival. Is everyone now present?"
"This is the lot of us," said a lean man with a taut, angular face, lavishly cobwebbed in tattoos. "You think one of us had it in for Terzet?"
"What is your name, sir?"
she asked. "Virak. Slater Virak."
"Well, Mr. Virak, I don't think any of you were responsible for Terzet Frilla's death. But it happened under unusual circumstances, and the nature of that death is of interest to Panoply."
Sator Virak gave a skeptical look to one of his colleagues. "Someone caring about us? That's a first."
"I'd like to know as much as you can tell me about Terzet Frilla. Were they a good worker?"
Virak shrugged inside his suit. "Enough to depend on, but it's not as if they'd been working on the team for years and years."
Talia nodded.
"How long, exactly?"
"About a year, I'd say," answered a woman sitting behind Virak. "A little longer."
She had a lazy drawl and a glittering green multifaceted artificial eye, jammed into her socket like a fat jewel. Her helmet, cradled in her hands, had a beaked protuberance, which made it look like a turtle's head.
"Terzet and I worked together quite a lot. They cut a few corners now and then, but they were still someone you could trust."
"And you are?" Talia asked.
"Brig. Been on the squad about 2 years. I was a skyjack before, but the pay's better here." "Maybe not the working conditions or the life expectancy," said a deep, raw-throated voice from the back of the room. "But if I wanted a quiet life, guess I'd have signed up as a prefect."
"Yes. It's a bed of roses being a prefect," Talia said. "Where is the body now?"
"Next door," Brig said.
She was doing something to her helmet, touching up an area of the artwork with a fine stylus.
"Nothing we could do. That suit looked old to me, just waiting to go wrong. I kept telling Terzet to get it overhauled. You take enough chances out here as it is, no sense in not being able to depend on your suit."
"What do you think went wrong?"
Talia asked. What'd it look like, Prefect? Thermal control stopped working. Cooked to resent like meat in an oven. Nothing pretty about it, either.
Hope you've got strong stomachs.
We'll worry about our stomachs. Her tone turned colder, more formal. Show us to the body, please.
Anyone want to draw the short one? Asked Virak.
I'll do it, Briggs said, snapping her stylus away into a sort of paint box.
Talia and Spava followed Brig into an adjoining room that was sealed off by a pressure bulkhead. A long rectangular equipment container had been converted into a makeshift mortuary slab. Trezet Frilla's space-suited form was resting on the container, strapped down to prevent it drifting loose. The bulkhead door had closed behind them. Talia moved around the body, taking it in without comment. The suit was just as motley and colourful as the ones the others had been wearing, but Talia did not think it looked significantly older or in less good repair. Maybe a few more dents, a few indication of parts being swapped or crudely repaired, but nothing that marked it out for imminent failure.
Was there any warning, Brig? Did they feel unwell? Strange? Anything like that?
We never heard any warning. That was part of the problem, though. The comms were always dropping out.
Generally, or with this suit?
Both, but especially with Terzet's equipment. Some loose circuit somewhere in that helmet got worse and worse over time. Not that it mattered, mostly. We had our work assignments, and a lot of it didn't depend on communication. Talia thought of Terzet Frilla experiencing the first warning signs of wildfire, and being unable to call for help. What had happened to Antal Bronner was bad enough, but at least he had been surrounded by other people, able to communicate his distress, even if no one could help him. But to be stuck in the iron bottle of a spacesuit, denied even the solace of one's cries being heard.
Did they have enemies that you knew about?
Talia asked.
Look, I'll be honest with you. We were on friendly terms, but no more than that. Even when Terzet was on the slab getting worked on, I was the one who had to keep the conversation going.
The slab? Spava asked.
I get it, Talia said. You were the one who painted all these spacesuits.
You don't have to be good to get this gig. Chirchik was the artist everyone used, until she got caught in the transfer wheel when it started moving. Because I cleaned up after her, I got to inherit her paints and brushes.
You're not so bad,
Talia said, thinking of her father's watercolors.
Nothing too hard about it. They tell you what they want, you paint it for them. Chirchik left a book of designs. Most of the time they pick something from the book, and you stencil it on.
Talia surveyed the artwork decorating Terzet Frilla's spacesuit, trying to find some common theme or sudden insight into their character. But there were too many disparate images for her to make easy sense of them. Burning skulls, flaming ships, clusters of stars and comets, other space-suited figures, sketchy representations of artificial worlds and their interiors, an island with a single bony white tree, its angular branches holding white fruit. She supposed the art commemorated earlier assignments, hard-won jobs and fallen comrades.
"We'll need to remove the helmet," Spava said.
"Go ahead," Briggs said, sounding unsurprised.
The neck seal had been only loosely reconnected. Talia snapped it wide, then tugged the helmet slowly back from the neck ring. Although she had been preparing herself, the shock was still considerable. It was an acrid melange of spoilt meat, waste food, urine, and sweat, left to mingle and amplify in the equivalent of a pressure cooker for what smelled like weeks rather than hours. She tightened her lips, hoping her natural revulsion did not show too strongly.
"Did you ever hear of this sort of thermal overload before, Brig?"
"Once or twice, maybe."
Talia set the helmet aside on a friction surface. They could all see Terzet Frilla's head now. It was pale and puffed out, like a piece of bread crudely shaped to look like a person. Blood had burst from the nose, eyes, mouth and ears, and crusted dry. The mouth was open, the swollen features lending the corpse a sordid, cherubic appearance. Talia turned to Brig.
"Would you mind leaving us for a short while?"
"No, I don't mind. Not that I understand why the death of one of us is such a big deal."
"I appreciate your cooperation.
We'll only need a few moments alone. She waited until Brig had left the room and closed the door behind her.
Frilla's too far gone to be any immediate use to Dr. Demikov,
Talia said. But he'll still want to open the head up, Sparva said. What's he hoping to learn? There's nothing in there but boiled meat. You can be the one to tell Demikov he isn't going to get some evidence to poke at. Even if there's nothing he can get from the implants, he'll want to verify that it fits the pattern of the other deaths. Just as long as we don't have to sit with that body next to us, all the way back to Panoply. Talia put the helmet back on the body, then followed Sparva through into the reception area. The workers were already looking restless and impatient. Brig was in the middle of a heated discussion with three others, voices rising to the point where it seemed a fight might break out at any instant.
I know this may seem like an overreaction, but Prefect Bankal and I will need to take Terzet Frilla back with us to Panoply. You have my word that the body will be treated with respect and returned to you in good time.
You can take the body, Virak said dismissively, but the suit stays with us. Tell them, Brig.
How it works around here, she said. Your suit is your credit. It's how you pay your way into the squad. Move shifts around. Trade up to better equipment. Friller was deep with the collective. We all own a piece of that suit.
You said it was in bad repair,
Talia told her. It was. Is. But we'll cut it up. Divide our share of it. Brig knuckled the alloy shin of her own suit. Can always use replacement parts. Cut them out, weld them in. The tradition is you keep the artwork as it is. That way you're always carrying a piece of someone else's life.
Talia nodded. I understand. And I've no wish to disrespect your traditions. Can you assist me in removing the body from the suit? Prefect Bankal will go back to the ship for a forensic body bag.
If you don't need the suit, where does the body interest you?
Virak asked, narrowing his eyes suspiciously. But Brig said, she's just trying to do her job.
While Sparva went back for the body bag, Talia, Brig, Virak, and two other workers helped her remove the suit. It came apart at a number of seams, but the process was still exactly as unpleasant as Talia had expected. The hardest part, though, was fielding the continuing series of questions from Virak and his colleagues.
We've heard about those rumours, one of them said, that there's something building, something you can't stamp out. This wouldn't be about that, would it?
I wouldn't put too much stock in rumours, if I were you,
Talia said, with crisp politeness.
Then there's nothing in what that man says, Brig asked.
Which man?
Talia replied, trying to sound only mildly interested in the answer.
Nice try, Virak said.
Sparva came back just as they divested Frilla of the final parts of the spacesuit, now laid out like painted trophies on the gripping surface of an adjoining pallet. Talia and Sparva slid the body into the bag, sealed it, made their farewells, and went back to the ship. They stowed the body in one of the evidence compartments, then signalled Panoply and announced their imminent return. Talia took the corvette's controls, detached from the dock and backed slowly out of the way of the other parked ships. As soon as the nose was clear of any obstructions, she tapped the steering jets and applied cruise power, thinking she would be very glad when that bagged-up body was no longer her immediate responsibility.
You handled that well, Sparva said.
I'd have come down with the weight of the law, insisted we take what we ask for. But sometimes the gentle touch works wonders.
It's called diplomacy. You never know when we might want those people on our side again.
Demikov won't complain, anyway. He wouldn't have given a second glance at the suit in his hurry to cut open some bone. At least they all get to keep a part of Frilla now. Talia applied emergency reverse thrust, both of them straining forward in their couches.
Did I miss something?
Sparva asked.
No.
She turned the corvette around and aimed it back at the 8-spoked wheel.
But I think I might have.
Vanessa Lauer raised an indifferent eyebrow as Dreyfus approached, soft shuffling along the humming floor.
Come to quibble over my analysis?
No, Dreyfus said. I was coming to thank you for expediting that search as quickly as you did. Unfortunately, the numbers still aren't large enough to produce a convincing correlation.
I'm going to ask something more of you.
And there was me thinking you'd come all the way down here just to thank me.
Niceties over with, Dreyfus settled his features into a business-like mask. It was a relief to be back on familiar terms. At least they both knew where they stood. You have access to all new case files as they come in. Friller is the latest, but we can expect a new one within the next 26 hours or so. Continue looking for risk factors, and keep updating that likelihood parameter. That's the easy part.
Oh, good.
In parallel with that, assuming the risk propensity is a common factor, I want you to give me an estimate of how many more cases might be out there. Healthy, happy citizens, just walking around unawares, completely oblivious to the fact that their heads may be about to explode.
You've got to be kidding, Drivers. This is a castle built on sand, and now you want to build another one on top of it?
Whatever metaphor suits you, Vanessa. All I want is your best guess for how many non-affected citizens might fit the same profile. If there are 1,000 potential victims out there, I need to know. 10,000. 100,000. However many it is. That way we can begin to draw up appropriate plans.
And if it's more than that?
Then forget making plans. We'll be busy enough digging graves. When he was done with Lara, he went to the refectory, grabbed an apple, and made his way to the tactical room, polishing the apple on his thigh as he walked. He pushed through the doors to find Aumanier and the usual retinue of seniors and analysts present. One of the analysts was reading solemnly from a list of technical procurement delays and cost overruns, his voice taking on a chant-like drone as he recounted each item. Aumanier seemed glad of the interruption.
"Tom, good, come in. It's about time we discussed the Grobno problem."
Dreyfus eased into his customary seat, to the right of Aumanier and between Clear Mountain and the dour-faced analyst who had just been interrupted. "Actually," he said, "I don't regard it as a problem. More of an opportunity." He crunched on the apple, ignoring the frowns from some of the less experienced operatives. Antal Bronner was a genuine instance of death by wildfire, but to Grobno's employers it looked like a hit by a rival squad of ultras, trying to get their own back on the Bronners. They assumed Giselin Bronner was next, so they sent Grobno in to squeeze her for secrets before the others got to her.
"That hardly exonerates Grobno," said Clear Mountain.
"I'm not saying it does. Just that pushing him through our judicial apparatus would be a waste of time and resources. We'd be better off directing at Wildfire."
"So we just let him go?" Clear Mountain asked.
"He'll get his day in court," Dreyfus said. "Do you remember Seraphim? My friend in the swarm." "All right, friend might be stretching it. But the Harbormaster and I have depended on each other before, and I feel I can trust him. He's given me his categoric assurance that Grobno will receive a fair and open hearing once he's returned to the Ultras." "A fair and open hearing where Ultras are concerned?" Clear Mountain asked, looking around with a cynical smile. Dreyfus took a final crunch from his apple, and allowed the browning core to drop to his feet, where it was detected and quickly absorbed into the floor. 2 years ago we depended on the Ultras for help. Nothing's changed since then."
"No,"
Ingvar Tench said, "other than a complete shift in the public mood, the undermining of confidence in our authority, and a growing mistrust of foreign elements like the Ultras. Fortunately, the public don't make our day-to-day decisions for us," Dreyfus said dryly. "The Ultras are here to trade. Everything else is incidental. If they harmed the Glitter Band, they'd be cutting off one of their main avenues to profit." He paused, directing his address at Aumanier, sensing this was his one chance to make a persuasive case. "I think we all agree that hard times may lie ahead, be it wildfire or the breakaway crisis. Under these circumstances, we may well end up depending on the Ultras again, perhaps more so than last time. Even the smallest gesture of trust that we can offer them now may be vital." Seraphim agrees.
"He's hardly a disinterested witness," Aumanier said.
Dreyfus conceded her point with a slow, dutiful nod. "All the same, He and I have kept open channels of communication since the Aurora affair. I wouldn't want to spoil that good work.
Then your proposal is?
She asked. I'll take Grobno back to the parking swarm. Hand him over personally. It won't take me long, and I'm due a visit to Hospice Idlewild anyway. There was a silence from the gathered prefects and analysts. Even Dreyfus's bluntest critics knew better than to comment on his business at the hospice.
I would be glad to wash my hands of Grobno,
Aumonier said, and you're right about the relations with the Ultras. I don't like their ideas of justice, but I'd sooner have them on my side than against it. And if you were going to visit the hospice, as, of course, you must, then the proximity of the parking swarm would save a second round trip. From a perspective of self-interest, I'd like to minimize the time you're away from Panoply. I'm glad I can be of use, Dreyfus said, already rising from the table. Chapter 6. Most of the workers had dispersed back to their work assignments by the time Talia and Sparva returned to Carousel Addison Lovelace. Less than a dozen were still in the meeting area, loafing around in their motley spacesuits, making idle conversation as they carried out minor repairs, or finished some desultory game of cards or dice.
"I thought we'd seen the last of you," said a deep-voiced man.
He had a prominent motile brow ridge, as if there were a tube of well-exercised muscle above his eyes. Two plastic lines curved up from under his chin and went into his nostrils.
"You got what you came for, didn't you?"
"Who are you?"
she asked.
"I'm Malian Ross."
"Very good, Mr. Ross. Do me a favour and call Brig back."
Ross scooped up his helmet, jammed it on loosely and spoke in a low voice, evidently using the worker's private communication channel. Talia crossed her arms and waited patiently. A few more workers packed in their games and went back to their duties.
"Any time you feel like telling me?"
Sparva whispered. 10 minutes passed and Brig returned, looking flustered and prickly about being summoned back so soon. She set her beak-faced helmet aside and fixed Talia with a wordless, quizzical stare, green light flaring off her jeweled eye.
"I'd like to see the suit again," Talia said.
"We explained. You don't get to keep the suit. It's our property now, not yours."
"Let me clarify something,"
Sparva said. "My colleague was being very reasonable with you earlier. She could have taken the suit there and then, but she decided to be nice about it. And now she's asking nicely again."
"I don't care how nice she's being. The suit stays here."
Sparva's hand moved to his whip hand, releasing it from its holster.
"Maybe you don't know what a Panoply enforcement action looks like."
Talia touched his wrist.
"I said I'd like to see that suit again, Brig. That's exactly what I meant. I want to look at it, not take it away."
"Why would you want—"
"I'd go along with her,"
Sparva said, making an ill-tempered show of snapping his whip-hound back into place. They went back into the adjoining room, Talia nodding at Brig to seal the door behind them. As far as she could tell, nothing had changed since they were last here, with the suit parts still laid out on the tractive surface, arranged in the rough anatomical order of the original suit. Talia picked up one of the larger pieces of detachable plating. It was a curved piece which fitted across the abdomen, tucked under the contoured breastplate of the life support system.
"Did you paint these scenes?"
"I painted whatever was asked of me. Does that make me a suspect now?"
"Is of? I'm just trying to get a better insight into Terzet Frilla's state of mind, their identity and preoccupations. From what I can gather, you wear your achievements on these suits?"
"It's no crime."
Talia sketched a finger across a scene from the middle of the plate.
"This landscape, this island with this strange white tree rising from the middle of it, was that yours?"
"What if it was?"
Talia was starting to think that perhaps the whip-hound was not such a bad idea after all, but she forced composure upon herself.
"Did Frilla explain the significance of this image? Was it related to something they'd been involved with in the past?"
"Why would you latch on to that?"
"Brig,"
Sparva said, a warning rumble in his voice.
The general idea is that we ask the questions, you answer them.
Brig drew breath and sighed. After some considerable internal struggle, something eased in her face. Perhaps she was beginning to realize the futility of putting up this non-cooperative front.
When you came back and said you wanted to get at the suit, I thought you were figuring one of us for sabotage.
No, Talia said, but there's something in this artwork that bothers me. The white tree, whatever it is.
It's not a tree, Briggs said.
Are you going to enlighten us?
Sparva asked. Again, Briggs seemed to wage a private war with herself before answering.
Terzette got on to this job for a reason. That was plain to all of us. We were here because the reclamation contract pays well, not because we were in any hurry to spend time in this place.
And Frilla? Talia asked.
Money drew the rest of us here, Briggs said, but that wasn't why Terzette came. At least, I don't think so. I don't think money was the problem. They never said much about the past. But you can tell when someone's slumming it, living below their means. Every now and then the mask slips.
And what was behind the mask?
Sparva asked.
Someone wealthy, or someone who'd had wealth not so long ago. The way they spoke, the places they'd been, you could tell. Also, Terzette had some sort of unfinished business to do with this place.
They'd been here before?
Sparva asked.
I don't know. Maybe. Whatever it was, it didn't sit well with the rest of us. People like Virak or Ross. I know what makes them tick. Same with me. Risking our necks here is the means to an end, not the end itself. But none of us were sure about Terzette.
You said it isn't a tree,
Talia said.
It's a place, a building. Here in one of the chambers we've been clearing out.
I'd like you to take us to it, Talia said.
It's just a building. Why has that caught your eye?
Because I thought I'd seen it before, Talia said. I wasn't sure and I needed a second look. But now I'm certain.
Sparva looked on, his expression giving nothing away. Dreyfus signed for a cutter, secured his prisoner in the only other seat, then locked in his destination as the parking swarm. The ship turned away from Panoply's pumpkin face, acceleration building smoothly as Dreyfus applied power.
You're a lying smear of shit, Prefect.
Dreyfus rewarded his passenger with an easygoing smile.
I didn't lie, Grubner. I said I'd speak up for you.
You say you care about justice. You have no idea what...
I have every idea, Dreyfus said, cutting him off gently. I've seen ultra-justice at first hand, and I know how cruel it can be.
Then you're a monster, if you know.
I don't know, Dreyfus mused. I'd rather go with pragmatist. Why are you so concerned about ultra-justice anyway, Grubner? Aren't they your people?
You don't understand them. Don't understand us. It won't be a fair trial.
Dreyfus made a sympathetic face. That's too bad. Fairness is all you deserve. Especially after the fair way you treated Giselin Bronner.
I didn't kill her.
You were giving it a good go when my operatives interrupted you.
I had a job to do. She wasn't going to die. I was going to take the pain flower off her before...
There. You've got your defense all lined up. What are you worried about? You'll sail through.
Bastard. I got caught, all right? That's what you don't do. You never get caught. They'll get to me. Punish me for making them look bad. You don't realize.
Dreyfus tuned him out, letting Grobno ramble on. He was still at it when the swarm came within visual range.
And I'll make you regret promising me what you did, lying to my face. You think you can get away with that sort of thing, but you're wrong. I've got friends as well. They'll...
Cheer up, Grobno. You're missing the view. Through the cutter's forward windows, the parking swarm was a tight-packed ball of ships about 100 kilometers across. Compared to the stately, regimented orbits of the Glitterband, it appeared chaotic. But there was order here as well, just not as obvious to the eye. Near the middle, where the ships were packed the most densely,
was the dark kernel of the Central Servicing Facility, a habitat-sized space station in its own right. Shuttles and taxis buzzed about, flitting between the facility, the parked ships, and the wider environment beyond the swarm. Movement of the larger interstellar vehicles was much rarer. Whole days or weeks might go by without a departure or arrival. When ultras came to trade with Yellowstone, they often measured their stopovers in months, or even years, using the time to perform long-delayed repairs or upgrades to their battered, time-worn vessels. The swarm was not quite lawless, but it was certainly a law unto itself. Panoply's technical reach encompassed even this volume of space, but the effectiveness of its authority here was at best debatable. In the past, prefects had paid the ultimate price for presuming they had immunity from harm within the swarm. Dreyfus had almost made that mistake himself, but now he took manual control and brought the cutter to a polite standstill, a few kilometers from the outer margin. He kept the cutter's weapons sheathed and waited for the sweep of a traffic radar to confirm he had been noticed. He flicked a control on the console.
Harbormaster Seraphim, it's Dreyfus. I came as agreed. Might I have approach permission?
A few more minutes passed before he had the luxury of a response.
Dreyfus, said the voice, buzzing from his console, as good as your word as ever.
I find it helps.
You've brought the package?
Dreyfus shot Grubnow a glance.
Yes. The package is sitting right next to me. We've had a merry old time.
There was a silence. The cutter's life support system gave out a faint hush of white noise, broken only by the occasional chirp from the proximity sensors on the console.
Bring him in,
Seraphim said. They had met before, and communicated on many occasions, but that did not make the harbormaster any less strange in Dreyfus's eyes. It was a strangeness tempered only by the knowledge that there were much odder varieties of human form among the ultras, some of which stretched the definition of human to breaking point.
Not quite the goodwill ambassador we might have chosen in these strained times,
Seraphim observed, nodding at Grubnow.
I trust you'll accept that our mutual friend was conducting his business in an entirely unofficial capacity.
If it's that or war, I know which I'd rather, Dreyfus said.
They were facing each other in a plush-lined reception room, deep inside the central servicing facility. Displays set into the walls showed cycling views of a dense, needle-like thicket of ships. Grubnow was secured and scowling in a corner, an improvised gag providing a welcome end to his interjections.
War?
Asked Seraphim, addressing Dreyfus from a huge surgical support chair, currently performing some sort of blood transfusion on its occupant.
You allow your people to go around murdering innocent civilians in the glitter band? Don't be too surprised when it gets interpreted as an official policy. Things are tense enough as it is.
Yes, I'm aware of your recent difficulties,
Seraphim said, voice buzzing from the metal grill which replaced his mouth. His head was small, the skin stretched tight over bony angles and contours. A tail of hair, carefully braided, hung down over his left shoulder.
Breakaway movements, dark rumours of a developing emergency, quite a bit on your plate. How's the tea?
I'll take it over whatever you're pumping into yourself.
Dreyfus sipped at the concoction that had been provided, doing his best not to pinch his features in distaste.
And I won't take up any more of your time than I need to. Grubnow's dirt. But having gone to the trouble of bringing him here, I expect him to receive a fair trial.
They won't look kindly on him, Dreyfus. It's bad enough to go meddling in glitter band business, but to go meddling and fail.
Yes, a double black mark. But what I said stands. He didn't kill Antal Brunner, and I'm minded to think he meant to leave Giselin alive.
The constables were stunned when he could have killed them. Dreyfus directed a telling glance at the gagged Grubnow.
He showed restraint. I expect there to be restraint in his trial. You'll see to that for me, won't you, Seraphim? I'm serious.
If I didn't think you were serious,
Seraphim said,
you would not be enjoying our hospitality. He paused to adjust a surgical line running into his arm. Rest assured that your generous opinion of him will be noted.
Good. I'll be watching developments. While I'm here, too, you can set my mind at ease over a related matter.
By all means.